Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Courthouse Steps Decision Teleforum, the Title VII Cases. My name is Greg Walsh, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Kurt Levy, the President of the Committee for Justice. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Kurt, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Greg. We're talking about a decision that came down yesterday, where the court, by a 6-3 vote, interpreted Title VII's prohibition against sex discrimination in employment to encompass discrimination based on sexual orientation or sexual identity. The case is Bostock v. Clayton County, and Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion. Now, I think, a decade or two ago, probably most of the debate would have been about, the very notion of such rights. Should gay and transgender people have rights? I think, by 2020, most Americans agree that, discrimination against LGBT folks is wrong. And in fact, most people I talk to seem to think it's already banned by federal law. They're surprised to hear Title VII doesn't cover it. Now, that's not to say that there are no complications like religious liberty issues, but I think most people support the general proposition. And, even the dissenters acknowledged, there is good policy reasons for wanting to expand Title VII. I believe Kavanaugh said that the policy arguments were very weighty, and Alito mentioned that it's painful to be reminded of the way that our society once treated gays and lesbians. Just certainly within the last several decades. So instead of, focusing on whether there should be such rights, the debate is really focused on whether courts are the proper branch for expanding Title VII. As Justice Kavanaugh put it in dissent, this case boils down to one fundamental question: who decides? And his answer was that, the responsibility to amend Title VII belongs to Congress and the president and not the Supreme Court or any court. And I agree with him, but Gorsuch, in his majority opinion, saw it differently. He said he wasn't doing anything like amending Title VII. He was doing nothing more than interpreting the text of Title VII. And he does focus on textual analysis, but his analysis is strained. The opinion, might be easy to dismiss, as just another example of politics masquerading as interpretation. If it had been written by one of the court's liberal justices, or, even I think by Chief Justice Roberts. But it deserves to be taken more seriously because Gorsuch is, a principled textualist. I mean, he's been consistent about that since he's been on the court. And again, Gorsuch does rely on, detailed textual arguments, which conservatives should at least be happy with that. Under Kennedy probably would have written the opinion a few years ago, and we would have gotten something, about the right to define one's own concept of existence. For those not lawyers or old enough to remember, that was the wording in the 92 Casey decision that affirmed Roe v. Wade. But, Kennedy has used language like that since, and like I say, probably would have again. Now, the case hinges on Title VII's command that it's unlawful for an employer to discriminate against any individual because of the individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Now, note, sexual orientation and identity are not on that list. But Gorsuch reasons that discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity is really discrimination based on sex, because the example he gives is, if a gay man is fired because he's gay, he's fired because he's attracted to men, even though a similarly situated woman would not be fired for being attracted to men. But that's a stretch, as Alito points out in dissent, because the employer's real objection is not, that he's attracted to men. It's the homosexual orientation. He would, in all likelihood, be equally upset about or, you know, prejudiced towards a woman who is attracted to women. You know, and Alito, I think, very well refutes, you know, Gorsuch's argument by pointing out that you could have an employer who, you know, didn't ask the biological or any type of sex of job applicants, but did ask whether they were, you know, homosexual or transgender and refused to hire them if they were. And that would be discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. But it couldn't be discrimination based on sex because the employer wouldn't even know their sex. You know, as Kavanaugh said in dissent, really anyone familiar with the use of the English language understands that the ordinary meaning, which is what we look at when we're talking about textual analysis, the ordinary meaning of sexual orientation or gender identity discrimination is different and distinct from the ordinary meaning of sex discrimination. I mean, federal law distinguishes the two. States that do ban sexual orientation discrimination explicitly distinguish the two. The court in its cases have distinguished the two. The advocacy groups that, you know, have pushed for the expansion of Title VII distinguish the two. So, you know, Gorsuch's reading of the text is not completely indefensible, but it's certainly not the most natural one. And, you know, Kavanaugh in his dissent quotes Scalia, quoting Leonard Hand, that a sterile literalism, or one could substitute textualism, loses sight of the forest for the trees. And I think that's sort of what's going on here. You can maybe say that Gorsuch's reading of the text is correct or plausible in some very technical sense, but, you know, it really loses sight of the forest for the trees. But, you know, even if we were to give Gorsuch the benefit of the doubt and say that his reading is as plausible as the alternative, he runs into the problem that his interpretation is completely at odds with the legislative intent. Not even the plaintiffs in this case claim that, you know, anyone in Congress in 1964 when Title VII was enacted intended the text to mean what Gorsuch says it means. Now, Gorsuch is correct that legislative history should never defeat unambiguous statutory text, but his claim that no ambiguity exists and that, you know, the answer here is clear, you know, really strains credulity. I mean, it certainly wasn't clear to the lower courts until just a few years ago. Every single court of appeals, 10 different panels, I believe, so that's 30 different judges, saw it the other way. So, you know, not only is it not clear, but, you know, it wasn't even close. I mean, Gorsuch's interpretation had a record of zero wins and 30 losses. You know, were the text as clear as Gorsuch imagines it to be, all the bills introduced in Congress over the last 45 years to protect gay and more recently transgender Americans from employment discrimination would have been redundant. But, you know, the advocates for those bills, and I, you know, remember them testifying in front of Congress, including civil rights officials from the Obama administration, you know, they all recognized that Title VII needed amending to protect against LGBT discrimination. And, you know, protecting against that discrimination is a noble goal, but the separation of powers and, you know, generally democratic principles instruct us that, you know, the job of amending Title VII to do that belongs to the elected branches, not the courts. Alito said that in a more fired up way. Let me see the quote here. It said, there's only one word for what the court has done today, legislation. Now, public opinion on gay and transgender rights are rapidly evolving. Congress would likely have extended Title VII to LGBT discrimination in the near future. And, you know, it would have had the imprimatur of wide public support. But instead, you know, now the expansion of Title IX, you know, has the taint that comes from being imposed by unelected judges. So, you know, really would have been better for all concerned to have gone the legislative route. And that requires a little bit of patience, but that's true of all legislation. You know, moreover, courts are not equipped to engage in the, you know, complex policy compromises that are necessary when expanding something like Title VII. Instead, we get a binary decision, which in this case left difficult questions about, for example, whether sex-segregated bathrooms and locker rooms would be legal in the workplace, the degree to which, you know, there can be accommodation of an employer's religious convictions. And it may even spill over to Title IX, which bans sex discrimination in educational institutions. For example, it could, you know, make it a lot easier for, you know, men to play on and perhaps displace women on women's teams. I just saw an article just a few hours ago in a higher education publication, you know, that said that, you know, yesterday's decision could transform Title IX. Now, Gorsuch said these are all questions for future cases, you know, not the cases that before the court. And yeah, it's put off for now. But, you know, these questions are sure to cause divisive battles precisely because they haven't been addressed in a thoughtful or really any way, as they would have been had this been done legislatively. So I know a lot of conservatives are disappointed with Gorsuch after tomorrow. I guess, you know, question is, should we be? Well, we certainly shouldn't be because, you know, we don't like the outcome for those who don't like the outcome. You know, let's leave the outcome-oriented, you know, judging of Supreme Court opinions to progressives. They're good at that. You know, in fact, I think Gorsuch's opinion is really a dramatic illustration that conservative judicial principles like textualism are not just, you know, an excuse, a cover for outcome-oriented judging, as, you know, liberal legal academics, you know, always like to claim they are. Sometimes they lead to results that the judge using them would not have wanted if it, you know, been up to him. You know, that being said, you can be principled and wrong. Those aren't mutually exclusive. And, you know, in this case, I think, you know, Gorsuch is probably wrong. I think the dissents have the better argument here. You know, finally, I don't think we should let the focus on Gorsuch, you know, following this, the decision, obscure the fact that Roberts once again sided with the courts for liberals. And, you know, he's making a habit of that. I mean, he did it on the census citizenship question, the New York gun case, our deference to the administrative state. Those are the most prominent examples over the last 12 months. So, you know, if he wasn't already, he's now firmly established as a moderate swing vote that's, you know, really up for grabs. So, you know, next time that, you know, you hear a Democrat screaming about the Supreme Court being captured by conservative ideologues and, you know, threatening to pack the court, you know, just remember there are at least as many reliable liberals on the court as there are conservatives and, you know, maybe more. So anyway, that's probably a good place for me to stop and see if you, Greg, or the audience have any questions.
Well, I'm sure the audience does. If I definitely do as well. Let's go to audience questions. We'll now go to the first question.
Hi, good morning. My name is Prashant. I'm from UCLA. I want to ask about the idea of legislative intent. There's one argument that says that legislature did not, like Congress did not really contemplate this idea. What do you make of the larger legislative intent in this case, in the Civil Rights Act, which is the idea that personal characteristics should not be the ones defining your employment status or how you're treated at work? What about that larger, broader understanding of legislative intent? Thank you.
I'm not sure that I understood every word you said, but I think you were saying something along the lines of that you could read the legislative intent in a broader sense to say that, you know, Congress was banning every type of irrational discrimination at work. Is that what you were asking?
Yes.
I mean, you know, I guess if the statute was written differently, you could say that, but it does give, you know, it does give a very specific list, race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So I think in this particular case, you know, it's hard to make that argument.
Thank you.
Hi, John Vecchione. I have two quick questions. One, I don't have any evidence that this isn't Gorsuch's preferred outcome. So the argument that you go against what your preferred outcome is, I have no evidence of that. But my second question is, where does this put bisexuals? It strikes me that even under Gorsuch's opinion, the way he writes it, if someone is equally attracted to men and women, there is no discrimination on sex either way by the employer. And I'm wondering if that's a future problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely holes in Gorsuch's reasoning. You've just pointed out one, and, you know, Alito pointed out another one. You know, what if the employer doesn't know the gender of the applicant? But let me get, and you know, there's other holes in it. You know, people have pointed out that, you know, you have to make certain assumptions about, you know, the fact that, you know, one of the plaintiffs here actually was Now, you know, I've already forgotten. I think it was originally a man who became a woman. You have to, you know, already, in a sense, partly answer the question posed to the court by saying that it's, you know, a genuine woman. But, you know, as to what was in Gorsuch's mind, I don't know. I just don't, you know, I mean, it's certainly possible. And I would jump to that conclusion for, you know, several of the justices on the court. But I'm not ready to jump to that for Gorsuch, because I think he has been very principled. So, I mean, you know, I'm convinced that, you know, he had the worst of the argument, and I assume you are as well. But, you know, he's probably at least as smart as us, probably smarter. And so we have to open, you know, ourselves to the possibility that he sees it differently, or even that, you know, he's just wrong. Again, you can be principled and wrong. So, you know, again, this is the beginning of, you know, a drift to Roberts land by Gorsuch. But, you know, my instincts tell me it's way too soon to conclude that, and that, you know, he certainly deserves the benefit of the doubt. And I think, you know, this is a good, you know, let's use it for what it probably is, which is an example of where, you know, textualism certainly doesn't always lead the place that conservatives would like it to lead. Let's put it that way.
Let's go to our next caller.
Hello. Thank you all for having this call. I had a question about the implications of the method that Gorsuch used to make a determination about the meaning of sex and how that can apply to other areas of discrimination that are prohibited. So because he writes that discrimination based on homosexuality or transgender status necessarily entails discrimination on the basis of sex, does that kind of expanded view of the discrimination translate to other areas? For example, in the case of religion or national origin, a potential expansion of seeing attributes or actions inextricably bound with the individual's religion or national origin then can also be seen as discriminatory, as opposed to only, you know, actions or attributes blatantly associated with their national origin, religion, or what have you?
You know, could you give me a concrete example? Because I'm not sure I'm completely seeing your what you're getting at here.
Well, I haven't thought of a concrete example exactly either, but really just the idea that it's the understanding of sex is going out one step further than what you would naturally, like you mentioned, assume is included in the term sex. Can that sort of going one step further potentially be drawn out in other areas of prohibited discrimination, like religion, national origin, race, that it's the discrimination prohibited can include things related to those attributes of a person, even if it's not the most natural and specific version of that attribute of the person?
You know, as you're talking, the example that comes to mind, and I'm not sure it's analogous to Gorsuch's reasoning, is, you know, when people talk about, for example, is anti-Semitism covered by Title VI? That's the, you know, the racial version of Title IX that applies to, well, not just educational institutions, but entities getting federal funding. And, you know, some people view Judaism as, you know, being Jewish as a race. And then there's issues about, well, how about if you're Israeli, you know, Israeli citizen, maybe it's not your national origin, but you're Israeli citizen. Is that kind of like being Jewish? And then people will even argue that, if you're against the state of Israel, that means you're anti-Semitic. I mean, I think that maybe gets at sort of what you're talking about. I'm not sure it's analogous here, because I don't think Gorsuch is saying that these things are related to sex, although he does say that also. That part of the opinion, I'm not really quite sure why he brought that in. Maybe he just felt like he needed extra ammunition. What he's really saying is this is just inherently sex discrimination, you know, that sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination is sex discrimination. It's not related to it. Now, he does do the other thing that comes to mind as you ask your question, is he does rely very heavily on the fact that it, you know, under Title VII, it doesn't have to be the only cause. So, you know, he says really in his example, you know, there's two causes. One is that the person is a man, the employee is a man. If it was a woman who was attracted to men, you wouldn't care. And then, you know, the second characteristic is is who they're attracted to. Again, I didn't find that, you know, argument particularly persuasive, but I mean, he's right. It doesn't have to be, you know, if it's a but-for cause, it doesn't have to be the only cause. He kind of maybe hints at what you're talking about, but again, I'm not even really sure why he got into that. I mean, at the end of the day, I think he just, you know, needed to stick to his theory that it's inherently sex discrimination. I hope that answers your question.
Let's now go to the next caller.
I just had a question about how you would square the Chief Justice's vote in this case with his vote in Obergefell, because it seems like the same argument that would apply, that discrimination against homosexuality is discrimination based on sex, would have also equally applied to an equal protection argument with regard to the same-sex marriage laws. It seems like there is an inconsistency in his reasoning that's unexplained.
Well, of course, you know, Obergefell wasn't decided on equal protection. It's always hard to know, as I talked about with, you know, Kennedy talking about the meaning of one's existence, hard to know exactly what constitutional provision it was grounded in, but substantive due process, if anything. So, you know, maybe the easy answer to your question is that, you know, there wasn't an equal protection analysis. But, I can't remember if it was one of, you know, who in dissent pointed this out. But, you know, if it had been true all along since 1964 that sexual orientation discrimination was sex discrimination, then it's too bad the court didn't know that, because there's a lot of cases in the last, you know, 20 years or 25 years where they've struggled with, you know, issues of Obergefell and cases before that, where it would have been really easy, you know, if it was sex discrimination. Well, you know, we have a long body of law on that. So I get your point, and I think, I think you're right. In a sense, Gorsuch's argument proves too much.
Let's now go to the next caller.
Yes, hi. Thank you for doing this. This is Tom Lobianco with Business Insider. Just a question, looking at, I guess, sort of the campaign implications of this. You know, one of the reasons that many conservatives came back into the fold with Donald Trump in 2016 was on the Supreme Court question. Wondering if this raises any questions or any concerns about the reelection just a few months from now, whether this tamps down any enthusiasm for Trump.
Well, I'm sure we won't be hearing Biden argue don't vote for Trump because he appointed someone who's not as conservative as we thought. But you're saying will it dull enthusiasm? You know, I don't know. I mean, it really shouldn't. You know, Gorsuch has been very good. You know, on average, GOP appointees, you know, have been, you know, not always very disappointing, but, you know, maybe on average a little bit to the left of what was expected. And I think Gorsuch is, you know, if anything, probably been a little bit more conservative than we expected. You know, I would hope that conservatives are not looking for an appointee who, again, always gives them the policy outcome they want. That wouldn't be a conservative judicial philosophy. That's just activism. And, you know, and not even one where they agree with the legal reasoning every time. Like I said, you know, Gorsuch is a smart guy. I don't think because we disagree with him once, we can say that, you know, there's something sinister going on or, you know, Trump made the right pick. So, again, you know, we'll see what happens. There's a bunch of big decisions still come in the next few weeks. But based on this, I would be surprised if Trump loses many conservative votes.
Awesome. Thank you.
Let's now go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Bob Fitzpatrick. An oral argument, Justice Ginsburg.
I'm sorry, caller. Would you mind speaking into the mic a little bit more?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that. Bob Fitzpatrick here in D.C. An oral argument, a number of the justices, including, as I recall, Justice Ginsburg, was concerned about sports. And I'm probably not using my terminology politically correct now, but a man who has now become a woman has lately been allowed to participate in female sports, and people are pushing back, complaining, women who started as women and still are women, that they're being beaten by people who are essentially females carrying male hormones. That issue, I gather, was that can was kicked down the road for the future. Can you give us some idea of how, given Gorsuch's holding on sex covers all this, how they might work their way out of that problem in the sports arena?
Yeah, I mean, most of the cases going on are going on under Title IX. The most prominent one is in Connecticut, and that's being litigated right now. The Justice Department and the Office of Civil Rights and Education are litigating. And, you know, there it's really a matter of conjecture how this case would affect Title IX, since it doesn't, you know, didn't directly address Title IX. But I suppose, you know, professional sports, you know, I haven't really thought it through, to be honest, but, you know, in professional sports, you're an employee. So, you know, I don't know how that, you know, that could be a more immediate effect. I'm not sure why we have, you know, why most of the cases have been in school rather than professional sports. Maybe it's just a simple answer that there's a lot less professional athletes than there are people playing sports in schools. I mean, and you have to be really, really, really good to be a professional athlete. But, you know, maybe we'll see more of those cases after this decision. You know, that's, you know, one of the, you know, when I said early on that I think most people support the general proposition that it's wrong to discriminate against gay and transgender people, I think the reason most people support that general proposition is because normally there's not someone hurt, assuming there's not, you know, religious objections and, you know, we're not talking affirmative action where you're taking someone else's job, you know, who's really, you know, hurt if you're not discriminated against, you know, I mean, probably no one. But, you know, when it comes to sports, you know, if you're a woman and you have to compete against someone who was previously a man, I mean, potentially there's real harm there. And, you know, those are exactly the types of things that could have been dealt with in legislation, probably would have been dealt with in legislation. I'm going to guess that, you know, that there might have been a carve out for that. But again, when you have, you know, these binary decisions by the court, you can't deal with those things. And so these are, rather than being solved, these are going to plague us. And, you know, again, Gorsuch can kick it down the road, but he can't make it go away permanently.
Let's now go to the next caller.
Hi, my name is Cliff Kincaid. I'm a columnist. I would like to get your reaction to what I'm hearing from the conservative grassroots. And that is that they're very, very disappointed, even angry over this decision. They compare it to Roe v. Wade, the gay marriage decision, now this. And frankly, a number of them are telling me that they expect conservative legal groups and people like Kurt Levy and Carrie Severino, the Federalist Society and Heritage, to apologize for pushing somebody like Gorsuch, getting him nominated, getting his nomination confirmed, after telling us all in the conservative grassroots that he was a great conservative. Kurt Levy said he was a results-oriented conservative. And now we see that he misuses Antonin Scalia's legacy. He totally twists the idea of being a principled textualist into making this sweeping decision, wiping out the laws in almost half the states of the United States. Why don't you, Kurt, and the others who pushed this nomination down our throats, have the decency to apologize?
Well, I certainly didn't say that tout him as a results-oriented conservative, because that's not something I believe in. I don't want a results-oriented conservative. That's just conservative judicial activism. Carrie, I know, I mean, I saw her tweets. I think I saw a statement. She is very upset about this. I'm not saying I'm happy with it. I'm just saying, you know, for example, you compared it to Roe v. Wade. I'm not telling you that, you know, this is a brilliant piece of legal reasoning, But let me remind you that at least he took a textualist approach. You know, if you remember Kagan's favorite words, where, you know, we're all textualists now, that may not be true, but I'd still prefer them to, you know, attempt the textualist approach, even if they're going to go off the rails. Again, if Kennedy had been on the court, you would not have gotten a textualist approach if he was writing the opinion. You would have gotten something about, you know, some gibberish, frankly, about the, you know, the right to define, you know, the meaning of your existence. And let me also remind you, nobody, you know, abortion is a very emotional issue for people because there are, you know, whether you think it's human life or not, there is a living thing that's dying. And the good thing about, you know, gay and transgender rights is, like I said, in most cases, it's not going to hurt someone. The fact that somebody is not discriminated against is not going to take a job away from somebody else. Again, there are exceptions that we've talked about, religious issues and, you know, men on women's teams. So, no, I don't feel like I have anything to apologize. Even if this is a terrible decision, I wouldn't have anything to apologize because we're not going to get, I don't know, can you point to a, you know, a justice who's always right? You know, it's pretty hard to find. If they could get it right 90%, even 80% of the time, I'd be happy. You know, let's compare it sort of to, you know, what's happened, you know, in my lifetime. There's been a lot of GOP appointees who were, you know, moderate at best, you know, many of them liberal, like, you know, Souter and Stevens, and, you know, even worse before that, you know, the Eisenhower appointees. So, you know, if we can get, you know, if we can get a judge who's a principled conservative 80, 90% of the time, I'll be delighted. I mean, that's really, you know, the best we can do, especially because you don't know in advance. You can't get inside somebody's mind. I don't think, you know, the people that we nominate, I don't think they even know what's going to happen, you know, once they're inside, you know, Washington with all the pressures involved. So, again, I'm happy with Gorsuch overall, and, you know, maybe I'll be proven wrong, but right now there's no reason to apologize.
Let's now go to the next caller.
Well, don't throw me into the demand an apology camp, but the language that I hear sounds an awful lot like the language we heard after Roberts made the decision in the Obamacare case. And 4 or 5 years later, I think we have a clearer picture of what Justice Roberts was really all about. And I fear deeply that that's what we're now seeing with Gorsuch. Particularly, I would ask, I've heard the phrase, you can be principled and wrong, but that's especially the case if you apply the principle the wrong way. I don't for the life of me see how you can define sex as binary and then call this a textual application of the word sex.
Well, again, I think I've already forgotten the first. Oh, I know. You were talking about Roberts. Now, if you look back, when Roberts made that Obamacare decision, I immediately, you know, excoriated him. That was just, you know, obvious attempt to split the baby, a very bad attempt at it because, you know, he may have split the baby conceptually, but he certainly didn't in terms of the result. You know, and we immediately suspected that was due to pressure. Again, you're asking me based on one sort of, you know, what I think not well-reasoned opinion to assume that, you know, Gorsuch is completely off the rails and, you know, that there was some sort of pressure here, you know, whether imagined by him or actually applied. I just think, you know, you're assuming way too much. But, you know, I, for what it's worth, you know, back in, was it 2012 when we had the Obamacare decision? I mean, I feared the worst then, and, you know, we got the worst. Well, it's not the worst. I mean, he could have been Stevens or Souter. So it's not the worst, but, you know, we got what I feared at the time, which is a, you know, a moderate, and in a sense worse than a moderate, a very sort of politically minded moderate.
Yeah, that was a harbinger. That's my point. It was a harbinger. And at the time, I did hear a lot of language. Well, that was just, you know, one bad day at the office. It turned out to be a hell of a lot worse than that. It was a trend. It was the beginning of a trend.
Yeah, I didn't think it was one bad day at the office. You know, I don't know if you can Google it, but I was, you know, one of his harshest critics at the time. And my feel is different now. Again, you know, maybe I'll be proved wrong, but I just don't have the feel that, you know, this is the beginning of Gorsuch becoming a Roberts.
Let's now go to the next question.
Hi, this is Teresa Manning. So one comment and one question with respect to the Republican or liberal conservative divide. If the left-wing ideological judges never veer right, but the so-called conservatives do sometimes veer left, in effect, you get a court that is always, even if only incrementally, veering left, which is what we've had for how many decades now? That's the comment. The question is that the exceptions clause of Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution authorizes Congress to amend or strip jurisdiction from the federal courts, including the appellate jurisdiction of the United States Supreme Court. So the question is, why are we never discussing how Congress is complicit in this grotesque overreach by our Supreme Court, even if only for the sake of education, civics education to the public, that there is, in fact, in the Constitution, a check on Supreme Court overreach? Why are we not having that conversation for the sake of education, even if that's the only benefit?
I think your first point is true. Conservatives are often at a disadvantage because they're more principled. I mean, even, you know, liberal political scientists will tell you, you know, the Democratic Party is basically, you know, a coalition of interest groups that keeps itself together by, you know, winning as many battles as it can, whereas Republicans are more a party of principles. And that doesn't mean they're always good principles, but it's held together by certain core beliefs. And in some sense, that's something to be proud of. In another sense, it hampers us because, you know, we're in a sense fighting with one hand tied behind our back. And that applies not just to politics, but to the court, as you point out. But I'm not sure what the alternative is. I mean, if the alternative is to be a conservative judicial activist, if that's what you're suggesting, that's not a road that I want to go down. Now, you know, the main people sort of, I actually, if you remember when Gingrich ran for president, he actually talked about ways, constitutional ways that we could push back. And I actually wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed saying, you know, I think this is a good idea. If nothing else, it gets the discussion going, reminds judges that they're not, you know, that they're not completely unaccountable. And, you know, I got a lot of pushback from my conservative friends. So, I'm not sure how much, at least in the conservative legal community, how much support there is for any of that. But, you know, there has been talk. You also mentioned jurisdiction stripping. Now, of course, there are debates about the constitutionality of that and who ultimately will get to determine the constitutionality of that. Well, the courts. And, you know, and they have. They have pushed back against it when it's been in front of them. That's not to say that they would strike down all jurisdictions. All jurisdiction stripping. But that's a dangerous game to play. Maybe for exactly the reason you said that, you know, the left is going to be better at it. So, you know, we'll probably never agree on conservatives, that is, on, you know, where, what areas we want to strip jurisdiction. But I'll bet you, you know, if we go down that road, I bet you I can guess one where, you know, Democrats will all agree they'll want to strip the court's jurisdiction on evaluating campaign finance reform. So again, I think it's a dangerous road to go down, but I certainly understand your temptation. And, you know, look back at some of the things that Gingrich suggested. I mean, I think there are, you know, ways in which we can, you know, we can push back without resorting to, for example, you know, court packing, which, you know, I mean, I suppose you can make an argument for a certain form of what people call it term limits court packing. It's really, you know, a little bit different, but the idea is you'd be opening up more spots with term limits. If something like that is done, in a principled way, maybe it's a good idea. Of course, you know, if court packing is used, because I think the Democrats use it as a threat to basically say to people like Roberts, you know, that's a very nice court you have. You know, if you don't want us to restructure it, as Senator Whitehouse said, you better stop being so evil. I don't know if that answers your question, but I am sympathetic to a couple of things you said. I just, don't want us to throw away our principles.
Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, my name is Barbara Haskins. I'm seeking clarification and you'll see why. The way I understand this ruling is that whatever my lived gender is, if I feel I'm male, I feel I'm female, if I'm bisexual, non-binary, whatever, that an employer cannot discriminate against me based on my lived experience with my gender. And the reason I'm saying this is because I got quite confused when I started hearing about who somebody wanted to have sex with. I totally lost the conversation at that point. Why does who I want to have sex with make any difference in this case? Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, trust me, this can get very complicated quickly, and I've even had a, discussion with a transgender person about this, and ultimately, you know, their answer was basically, you know, we shouldn't label things. That was their answer, because it was really too complicated to figure out, you know. So I can't even remember now what your question is, but yes, I mean, this all gets very complicated, and I thought you were originally going to ask, what about somebody identifying as a different race? Are they, protected? And, there's a somewhat different standard under Title VII for minorities than there is for the majority. It's not supposed to be a huge difference, but in practice it is. And maybe if you identify as a minority, then you're in better shape if you bring an employment discrimination suit. So I thought you were going to go down that road, but I guess even just sticking to gender identity, there's a lot of complications. And again, as the dissent mentioned, that's why you want to deal with these things legislatively, where you can actually look ahead and say, there could be a problem here. Let's deal with it before we expand Title VII.
Let's go to the next caller.
Hello, I'm Gerald Gruber in Fulton, Maryland. The very first woman that was on the phone said she had a question with Gorsuch's opinion, follow on to perhaps Title IX and things like, and things even different, like religion and so forth. And I think what she was referring to was Gorsuch's argument, which in part, I quote here, discrimination based on homosexuality or transgender status necessarily entails discrimination based on sex. The first cannot happen without the second. Well, that to me is no argument at all. That's just gibberish. That doesn't say anything. Let me explicate it. Instead of talking about homosexuality, let's talk about left-handedness. Discrimination based on left-handedness, entails sex. Got to have a sex first, male or female, and then you can talk about left-handedness. Well, that's stupid.
Yeah, again, I didn't really follow or at least find convincing, where Gorsuch gets into really there's two factors that you're discriminating based on. And again, he even talks at some point about sexual orientation and gender identity being related to sex. I'm not really sure what that adds. Like I said, I think he just should stick to his argument. I think it's, there's logical holes in it, but he should just stick to it that this is necessarily sex discrimination because you treat a man dating a man different than you treat a woman dating a man.
Perfect. Let's go to the next caller.
Yes, hi, my name is Maritza Bolano, and I'm calling because decision that Justice Gorsuch came down with is actually, in my view, a very important decision for all Americans to really think about and consider the implications of where our society is and where it's going. My understanding is, and I haven't had a chance to read the decision, but my understanding is that it is really tailored to workplace discrimination. There were other decisions involving gays and transgender issues, such as the wedding cake decision, which I believe it was a Gorsuch decision, where they found that that's a different case to have a religious objection to making a cake. This is not about a religious exceptions, a religious discrimination. This is about workplace. And the reality is that gay and lesbians, transgendered people need to be able to make a living, and they have a right in this country to make a living and not be lose their employment simply.
Ma'am, I don't mean to cut you off, but would you mind getting to your question?
So my question is that given that this is workplace discrimination, why is the objection from conservatives so virulent? I happen to be a lesbian, and I am also a conservative, and I uphold religious rights and freedoms, but I also have the right to make a living. And that's really my question is, would someone speak to the workplace issues? Because that's what this case is about.
Well, you're right. Title VII deals with employment discrimination. So, yes, at least on its face, it's limited to the workplace. And in most cases, there are not going to be religious issues. But, you know, and when there are, we already have a framework for dealing with it. You know, the so-called ministerial exemption, and, you know, that's being fleshed out as we speak. There's going to be an opinion coming down on that in the next few weeks. So, you know, we can debate, you know, how broad that is, but it's certainly the exception. In the vast majority of jobs that gay and lesbian and transgender people hold, you know, there's not going to be a serious religious issue. And as to why conservatives are, you know, so upset by this decision, I mean, I think, frankly, it falls into two categories. I think it's people who, you know, or maybe even three. It's, you know, there are legal purists who, you know, just don't like the fact that Gorsuch's opinion was a stretch. There are people who, you know, may not care that much about this opinion, but are worried about, you know, Gorsuch, running off the rails, because we've seen it with so many nominees. And then there are people who, just as a policy matter, you know, don't think there should be protection for transgender and gay people in the workplace. But I think that's not, I mean, they're entitled to their view, but it's not a good reason to object to the decision. Just like you shouldn't make a decision, judges shouldn't make decisions based on their policy preferences, you shouldn't criticize them based on your policy preferences either. I mean, that's not to say you have to like them, but, you know, to attack a judge because he followed a principled, you know, method of analysis and got an outcome you didn't like, that's not legit. Saying that it wasn't principled, that is legit. If you want to say Gorsuch was not sincere and he was up to something else, you know, like I say, I'm not convinced, but you know, that's a legitimate argument. But I disagree with conservatives who are just like, I don't like it as a matter of policy, therefore I'm mad at Gorsuch. I mean, you know, again, you're entitled, but you're not a true, you know, you're not a true judicial conservative if you judge things by outcome.
Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, it's Pepper Crutcher down in Mississippi. I'm an employment lawyer, and I'm intrigued by something. I want to ask you, how would you rule if you were a federal judge who had this situation in front of him? You had a defendant who just won a summary judgment in a Title VII case and applied for prevailing party attorney fees under Title VII. You now have a method of interpreting Title VII, which seems to me irreconcilable with the Christiansburg Garment Company decision from 1978. But nevertheless, you have that old Supreme Court opinion that says prevailing party means prevailing party if the plaintiff wins, but prevailing party doesn't mean defendant if defendant wins, unless the case is also frivolous when brought. So you write up the two Supreme Court precedents in front of you, one how to read Title VII and one how the court read Title VII, and what do you do, Judge?
Well, as a trial lawyer, you probably know the answer better than I do, but I don't even, I guess it doesn't seem difficult to me because it was not frivolous when brought, correct?
That's my hypothetical. So what you say is I'm going to abide by Christiansburg Garment Company in 1978 because that was the outcome in that case, even though the outcome was achieved by a selection of policy choices based on the thinnest cherry-picked legislative history without regard for the text or how the same words were used under other federal statutes. Now you've got the Gorsuch opinion reading Title VII, saying how to read Title VII contrary to Christiansburg Garment Company. I think what I'm suggesting here is I think Gorsuch's opinion is going to possibly, we know there are two votes for reversal on the court right now, possibly lead to reversal of Christiansburg Garment Company. What do you think?
I have no predictions. I'm sorry, but I just, don't know enough about, their track records, to really make a prediction there. By their track records, I mean the justices.
Let's go to the next caller.
Hello, my name is Jane Robbins. I wanted to just comment on a couple of things quickly. I do think that this was a thoroughly unprincipled decision. I don't even see the argument that this was a textualist decision. So I don't know what Gorsuch is doing. I don't know if he's just, I don't speculate on that. But you said a couple of times that this people generally are okay with laws against discriminating against homosexuals or transgender people or whatever, because they generally don't hurt anybody. But of course, especially in the area of people who identify as transgender, it does hurt someone. A specific would be an employee of a school who does not, of a private Christian school who does not, is not covered by the ministerial exception. So obviously that is a problem if you've got a male who is presenting as a female around children. So that's a specific, but a broader one is that this is a cultural embrace of a delusion, of falsehood. There is no scientific evidence supporting the idea that people can have a gender identity different from their sex. It is a delusion. It's a psychological issue. And that is just the scientific fact. And so when the court imposes that we now all have to affirm that, it's not only hurting society, it's hurting the individual who is in the grip of that delusion. Because now the whole world is affirming, yes, you think you're a woman, yes, you are a woman. It's like the whole world affirming a girl who has anorexia. Yes, you are fat, you do need to do something. It's a step down such a dangerous road, and I am just stunned that Gorsuch didn't see that.
I think you mentioned a few things. I don't know that, we don't know, how the court is going to deal with the religious implications here, but it won't necessarily be limited to the ministerial exception. Two, I think you're talking about, I think you're saying that for some people it's just not, not healthy to be transgender. And I'm not an expert there. But I think that's a separate question whether they should be fired or not hired based on that. If I thought of my own child, I might be, very upset if they became transgender because I might think it's not good for them health-wise or psychologically, but I wouldn't necessarily want them to, not be able to be employed because of that. And, I don't think, anyone – look, you don't have to in your personal life view somebody who switched from being a man to a woman as a real woman. But that's, again, a separate question of, should that person be, suffer adverse employment consequences? I mean, I can certainly imagine, and I understand the argument that, maybe you'll say something at work and that will be viewed as sexual harassment. And those are one of the complications we're going to have to deal with. I mean, I'm a big supporter of free speech. So again, as these are ironed out, I would be very upset if, merely expressing your views that you are the sex that you were born with, if that's enough to say that, you violated Title VII. But I think that's a different question than should you be able to fire somebody because they're transgender.
I think we have time for 2 to 3 more questions. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on whether Gorsuch's for causation logic would be applicable to race. even if, of course, it's wrong to apply it to specs. It's just that I imagine most people agree that Title VII would prohibit implied discrimination against a person in an interracial, say, as a form of discrimination based on race. But I'm not sure how we can get there without using Gorsuch's logic or something similar. I think Alito touched on the differences between race and sex in his dissent, and he said, like, the historical context was used to apply different standards or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, Alito did deal with that. You know, certainly people have made, you know, the people who wanted the court to be the ones to amend Title IX certainly made the, you know, the analogy to race. And, you know, I think Alito was right that it's not, it may not be a completely nonsensical argument, but it's not the same. Because if you ask somebody, you know, if you don't want to hire someone or you fire someone based on the race of their spouse, I think everyone would say that's racial discrimination. But if you don't hire someone or fire them because of their sexual orientation, you know, I think just about everyone in the common ordinary meaning would say you're discriminating based on their sexual orientation, not their sex. So in that sense, it's different. You know, the spouse of the race of your spouse, you know, we still consider that racial discrimination. We really don't consider sexual orientation discrimination to be, you know, to be one and the same as sex discrimination. And that's the whole, you know, that's the whole point I was trying to make, why I think that Gorsuch's opinion is a stretch. But it's not, again, I don't think it's crazy to bring up the racial analogy. I just think it's, you know, not very convincing to me. And, you know, I don't think it should have won the day. And, you know, well, I don't think the racial analogy won the day. I mean, one of the reasons that it came out the way it is because there's four liberals on the court, and, you know, they would have voted, you know, that way no matter what the reasoning. And so, you know, it really came down to all you needed was Gorsuch and Roberts. And, you know, again, I am sorry that it took the court to do this. I mean, I think this is something that, you know, could have been done legislatively in a way that would have had more popular support and could have dealt with all the problems we've been discussing. But, you know, again, with four liberals on the court, it only takes one so-called conservative to, you know, wander away and you get bad decisions.
Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Larry Joseph. I had two comments and a question. First, on the Chief Justice, it's at least conceivable that if he were the only judge deciding this case, he would have gone the other way. But as the Chief Justice, if he joins the majority, he gets to pick the opinion writer. And so it was a choice perhaps to him of either Justice Ginsburg is going to pick the opinion writer if it's a 5-4 decision, or if I join, I get to pick the decision writer and it becomes Gorsuch. So that's just one comment. Second comment on Title IX versus Title VII and the Connecticut sports thing. It's at least possible that Title IX would come out differently because it's spending clause legislation, which requires a clear statement, whereas this is Title VII is, I believe, equal protection clause legislation, and it's entitled to a broad meaning and whatever. So those are my two comments. Welcome any response. And then the question is, what bathroom do transgender people use? So, you know, I get you're not allowed to fire them for this, and that's called sex discrimination if you do, but how does that affect which bathroom they use?
Like I said, that is clearly one of the issues that, you know, the court is going to have to deal with at some point, because, you know, I think there's still a lot of broad public support for having sex segregated bathrooms, and I don't think that, you know, most people, certainly don't think most of our legislators, you know, would have included, you know, desegregating bathrooms, so to speak, if this had been done legislatively. I'm trying to remember your other questions. One about spending clause. By the way, Title VII is commerce clause, not equal protection. And, you know, yes, plain meaning for spending clause legislation, but shouldn't it be really the same standard for, you know, if you're going to, you know, not defer to Congress, you know, I think there should have to be plain, you know, meaning. I think if it's ambiguous, of course, Gorsuch tried to say it wasn't ambiguous, but if it's ambiguous, that's when, you know, you really have to defer to Congress. I mean, either Congress's intent or leaving it to Congress to amend. So, you know, I realize on paper it's a different standard, but, you know, I do think this is going to have ramifications for Title IX. Like I said, people in the education community are already expecting it to. And certainly, you know, when lower courts try to predict, you know, to some extent, you know, lower courts are always trying to predict how the Supreme Court might rule on things that it hasn't ruled on. And I think, you know, it probably wouldn't be wrong to, you know, to think that, you know, sex discrimination might also be, you know, broadly interpreted under Title IX. What was there? I think there were a few questions you asked me. Did I hit them all or did I miss one?
Just that the Chief Justice might have voted strategically rather than
I've heard that story. You know, again, I tend to prefer simple explanations to, I don't know if you'd call it a conspiracy theory, but, you know, sort of one involved bank shots. Now, if you've heard evidence to the, I have not heard evidence that that happened. If you know of evidence, then, you know, maybe we should talk about a bank shot. But, you know, again, given Robert's track record, I'm not, you know, I don't think you need a complicated, you know, theory of why he went the way he went.
Thanks.
Let's go to the next caller.
Hey, I spoke to you earlier and you forgot what my question was, so I called back. But in the meantime, I have a different thing to say instead, which is whoever said that gender dysphoria is 100% delusional, I would take issue with. I'm a psychiatrist, and she says there's no scientific evidence. That's incorrect. I think there's a spectrum of pathology. Some people, if there's no other pathology, it's just that's how they feel. And other people may have a coexisting personality disorder or something. So that's all I'm going to say. Thanks.
Yeah, I guess I would just say, I mean, if it's a personality disorder, then it's a disability. And then you're, you know, already protected under the ADA. Again, I just, you know, maybe I'm missing something here, but I just think, you know, it's two separate questions about whether you think, you know, changing your gender identity is healthy and, you know, whether you, you know, whether you should be able to suffer adverse employment consequences because of it.
Let's go to our final caller.
Yes, good afternoon. Great topic. Thanks for covering it. And just wanted to ask you several times that part of the issue here is that sort of there's no one else hurt. And as a business lawyer who's practiced for over 20 years, you know, I've frequently had to advise employers about these kinds of issues. And I think there definitely is a couple of classes of individuals who are going to be impacted by this. The employers themselves, number one. I mean, freedom of association is a legitimately grounded right in the Constitution. And since we spend most of our time at work, I think having some degree of latitude over who you choose to work with is a legitimate consideration. The other piece to that is other employees or potential employees. The number of times I've had clients who've been confronted with the hiring decision and, you know, one of them is of a protected class and the other is not. And the advice I've had to render is, look, the safe course is to hire or promote or retain the employee with the protected status. So I think it's a little disingenuous to say that there are, you know, there's no harm, no foul here. Law inherently involves balancing of interests, and the court has clearly put its thumb on the scale in one direction here.
Yeah. First of all, I didn't mean to say that there can be no harms. All I really said was that I think most people support the general proposition and that there are all sorts of complications and that those are things that Congress can deal with. And I don't really even have an opinion about, you know, what, you know, if we're going to expand Title VII, exactly where the boundaries should be. I'm just basically saying I think most people these days, well, most people think it already covers discrimination events against at least gay people. You know, freedom of association, as, you know, as an original matter, I mean, I agree with you, but we, you know, that you know, those of us who are big on free speech and freedom of association, we lost that battle, you know, in the 60s. You know, that has nothing to do with gay and transgender people. It, you know, first came up in the context of race, and, you know, the court decided that that wasn't a defense. And, you know, maybe it should be. I mean, I certainly understand the arguments, but again, I think the public at this point, you know, even if you can make sort of a, you know, purely legal argument for it, I think, you know, I think the public is, you know, does not think that freedom of association trumps, trumps the anti-discrimination laws. And then as to, I get what you say. I mean, you know, I don't know if it's occurring yet with gay and, well, this decision just came down, so I guess it isn't occurring yet. Whether it will happen that, in a sense, there's sort of an implicit, you know, affirmative action because people are, you know, afraid to, you know, not hire or to fire someone who's gay or transgender. But again, that's really not a new issue. You know, we've been dealing that with, you know, with that under the other categories covered by Title VII for a long time. I don't support, you know, preferences, which is basically what you're talking about, you know, racial preferences or gender preferences. And I would hope that doesn't happen here, but you're right. I mean, there's always the harm that, you know, that it could. I agree with you there.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speaker for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.